Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Bookbell of chickflix.net.
Oh, it's a rare episode. Hannah brought the wine.
I did. It's been a while and I felt like it was long overdue. And then I came across this wine.
Now, we've had this make before. This is a Zach Alexander Brown of the Zach Brown Band wine. Uncaged. It's not Stan and Ollie. It's not Cold War. I'm going to say glass because three of them are hanging out in a cell.
It's a little of everything. It's thematic. If you think beyond, you are right. It is glass because more directly of our heroes and villains kind of busting out of an institution. But beyond that, I think it is related to Cold War, where you've got these star-crossed lovers who are looking to break free from communist era, post-war Poland.
We'll get to why I already disagree with what you just said.
And you've got Stan and Ollie, who kind of, you know, are trying to, they're unleashing their act onto the world stage while they're attempting to sort of come back after being sort of caged, I think, by the old Hollywood studio system.
Man, Hannah, so, that is strong.
Isn't that
strong
deep?
Strong wine.
That's deep.
Good Lord.
And how's the wine itself, Charlie?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to drink it. It's good.
We usually don't
get wine that just... I just did a double take. if you could hear my double take, I was double tooken.
Well, I'm happy to oblige with a very thematic, deep kind of wine.
That's different.
Effort. So,
well, we have three new films to talk about tonight. One will probably be nominated for an Oscar, maybe even two. One tried for Oscars, don't think it will make it, and one will never be mentioned in any Oscar category, ever. And then following that, we will reprise week two of our new Agree or Disagree segment. We had a bunch of listeners contribute this week for our possible Agree or Disagree, we can launch at each other. You guys are awesome. Thank you for participating. But we'll get to those, so stay tuned to see if it was one of yours.
That's right.
But kicking off, the biggest film this week by far is M. Night Shyamalan's Glass. I am a Shyamalan fan, an apologist frequently, because he doesn't always... He always swings, but about half the time now he misses. I loved The Sixth Sense.
Mm-hmm.
I always will. I really liked Unbreakable and mm-hmm. Signs and The Village
mm-hmm.
and The Visit
mm-hmm.
and Split. I didn't care for The Lady in the Water.
Yeah.
I hated The Last Airbender. And, you know, so I appreciate that he's always, he'll try. Even if it doesn't work, he's like, you know what? Let's see what happens.
Yeah, he puts things out there. He definitely gets credit for trying to push boundaries and make people think about what he's trying to say. But yeah, he's sort of hit or miss. I love The Sixth Sense, and Unbreakable are probably my two favorites of his.
And you had to play catch up this
mm-hmm.
week because you cannot watch Glass without seeing Unbreakable and Split. It's a loose trilogy, but they connect heavily, and you watched Unbreakable this week.
Yeah, for the very first time, I watched 2000's Unbreakable. I found it on iTunes. It was actually kind of hard to find, and then I saw that Sci-Fi Network was actually showing it, the edited version, this week. So some people might be able to catch it on Sci-Fi before going to see Glass, if they're so inclined. But yeah, I'm so glad I saw it, because while I kind of remember the movie poster and I knew that it was starring Bruce Willis, I really had absolutely no idea what it was about. And if I had not seen that setup piece, which really is just about this guy David Dunn, who emerges unscathed from a catastrophic train accident, he's the sole survivor, and that captures the interest of this guy who's sort of on the opposite end of the spectrum, played by Samuel L. Jackson, who breaks his bones at the drop of a hat. And so here you've got these two different guys whose bodies respond so differently. And they are back in Glass. And Split was only a couple of years ago, and James McAvoy, I do remember seeing that one, and he played like 25 different personalities, and his performance was phenomenal in Split. So I remember not loving the movie, but really liking James McAvoy. So here in Glass, you've just got these three guys back together again, James McAvoy, Bruce Willis, and Samuel L. Jackson, and it's the dynamic between those three that makes this film somewhat watchable, but only if you've seen those two films.
Shyamalan is known for originality. He doesn't do sequels. He doesn't do even the same universe. So we did not know Split had any connection to any other film until like a stinger halfway through the credits at the end of Split when Bruce Willis showed up. And you're like, oh man, what's the connection? What are they going to do? I can't believe. All right, they actually take place in the same universe. That's the first time Shyamalan ever did that. And now he's sort of wrapping it up with Glass. There's three co-leads. Now, David Dunn, Bruce Willis, Mr. Glass, Samuel L. Jackson, and Kevin Wendell Crumb, and his 23 other personalities, played by James McAvoy, are all in a mental institution, a mental asylum. They're all in separate cells, they're shackled, and they start doing these group therapy sessions with Dr. Ellie Staple. I wonder if that's nominative determinism, by the way. Staple. She's played by Sarah Paulson, and she says, you know what? You think you are superheroes, or in Mr. Glass's case, super villains. And they're like, no, we are. We are. We know who we are. We have these powers. We can do these feats. Kevin can climb walls. He can bend steel. David Dunn really is unbreakable. He can just take it and take it and take it. And Mr. Glass is just a mastermind, an evil genius. And she's like, no, in the next 3 days, I'm going to convince the three of you, you are not superheroes. There are practical explanations as to why you can do what you do. This is a specific type of delusion of grandeur. And for whatever reason, she has some 3-day time limit, which is ridiculous.
That was never explained.
It's kind of a silly limitation. And so it's actually the majority of the film is methodical. It's slowly paced, it's deliberate, it's mental, and only at the end, and you know it's coming, is all hell kind of break loose, because at any given time, each one wants to kill the other two. Just so.
Yeah, and it's not so much that it's a superhero complex, but they all claim to be superhuman in some fashion, and so what I did like about this film, it was way too slow, I did not like the ending, but there is a sort of forced nostalgia factor. Certainly if you've seen, having seen Unbreakable just before seeing this, I immediately recognized the cameo. M. Night Shyamalan always has a cameo in his movies. And so it was kind of fun to see him referencing his cameo from Unbreakable 18 years later in Glass. And if you hadn't seen Unbreakable recently, you wouldn't get that line. And the same thing with the aging in real time. To see Bruce Willis's character, David Dunn, 18 years later, and his son, who was this young little kid in Unbreakable, is now sort of a business partner with him and is played by the same guy, Spencer Treat Clark. And that was really kind of wild to see how it's so rare sometimes to see a kid actor reprise a role all those years later and get right back into it and feel that same sense of connection between the father and son characters. So that part of it I really liked, and I wish there'd been a little more heart to Glass. I just didn't feel that there was in the end.
David Dunn, he owned Unbreakable. It was about him, a man who was unbreakable. Split was about Kevin Wendell Crumb, a man with 24 different personalities. And it was all James McAvoy all the time. Glass, you think, okay, now Samuel L. Jackson's turn. He gets his own movie. His name is the movie title. No, he doesn't even barely scratch the surface in his own movie. Shyamalan just couldn't figure out, I don't think, how to do it. James McAvoy, once again, gets most of the screen time. Him and Sarah Paulson get most of the screen time, and I'm fine with that. McAvoy was awesome in Split. I like Split better than you did. I love watching him just channel switch, absolutely, filter, yeah, between these personalities. He goes from 9-year-old boy Hedwig to conservative Ms. Patricia to Dennis to, I mean, you never know who you're going to get. And yeah, it's really fun watching him do it. He's so good. I can't believe he was not nominated for that. I wish he was in certain respects, because he was so good in Split. But unfortunately, why even call this movie Glass? It's not about glass.
Yeah, I'm sure that it's some metaphor that Shyamalan intends for us to figure out through watching this film. I don't think it's, I don't think Glass is meant to refer strictly to the Mr. Glass character, which is just an AKA for him. His name is actually Elijah Price, but in the movies. But I don't know. It just, he's, Samuel L. Jackson, yeah, did not really, his character doesn't quite match up in this film.
He gets more to do than Bruce Willis, who gets nothing to do.
He gets nothing to do but sort of reprise. He's, because he operates in the shadows and the, you know, it, that's sort of what he does as this vigilante. And so he's always been this quiet sort. And where you've got James McAvoy able to display all these different personalities is just going to command the screen. And I do love what they do with having this device whereby there's like a trigger for this change of his personalities. And it does remind you just how, what range he's got and how versatile he was. And the cool thing to remember about his character too, and this emerging personality called the Beast, is that the physical, the body chemistry changes with each adaptation of a character, of a personality. So when the Beast comes out, he's physically transformed. And then there's a character that's like a diabetic and has to have insulin shots. And I mean, it's just a fascinating aspect to that role. And so to be able to pull off that constant switch of characters, and because you've met them all before in Split, it's it makes it easier to track them in Glass. Again, I don't think you'd be able to track them as well if you did not see Split. Also, there is a reprisal of one of the characters from Split, this girl who'd been, teenager who'd been kidnapped by one of Kevin's personalities and survived the ordeal. And so she reemerges really briefly in this film. I don't think her character was really all that well developed, but she shows up to be sort of sympathetic to the Kevin character. And so it's a thinker in its own M. Night Shyamalan world sort of way. But it really is a gift more to Comic-Con fans who really like this kind of comic book genre. This is sort of a comic book thriller, I guess, is how they're describing it. But if you're not into that universe, you're not going to want to see Glass.
Overall, I did not like Glass. I do not recommend it. It's 3 of 3. If you consider this a trilogy, it's by far the third one. It's lesser Shyamalan. It's not his worst film. That's easily The Last Airbender. But it's in the bottom half. I didn't take to it. I didn't gravitate to it. I wanted to. I liked the characters in their previous films. And I thought, okay, put them all in the same room, and man, this is going to be a riveting film. It's not. I don't know if that's because it was, I don't know, he took it in a direction that I just wasn't feeling. And this, the all-out, there, of course, since it's Shyamalan, who wants to be this generation's Hitchcock, there are surprises and moments at the end. He always offers these offbeat answers. Sometimes you get answers. You know, sometimes a lot of people get angry when a film ends and there are no answers. Shyamalan never does that to you. He will always give you, this is why it happened, this is how it happened, here's the answer. And sometimes when you get that, you're like, no. Yeah. No.
Well, but what he also does is he plants new questions, and that leaves the world open for a potential that this could be, at the same time that there's some closure, it could be almost an origin story for some future endeavors. And so that's left open, that door.
Well, he wanted to make Unbreakable 2 after Unbreakable. That was his plan, and Warner Brothers called him and said, hey, Unbreakable didn't wow the box office. It didn't knock anybody's socks off. We're not going to finance a sequel. So he moved on and he did Signs. Good move for him. So he's had this in his back pocket, kind of Split and Glass in his mind for 18 years.
Yeah.
And now he, you know, now he's got smash and clout and Blumhouse Pictures behind him, and he can do these passion projects, which he couldn't do back then.
Well, this is like reading the third book in a trilogy, and you don't like the third book as much as you like the first two.
Mockingjay is not as good as The Hunger Games.
No, exactly. I was just going to use that as the example, that The Hunger Games, the first two books of The Hunger Games, are so much better than the third, and then the movies followed suit, where the first two were so much better than the final.
Remember, the third Star Wars movie had Ewoks in it.
Yeah. So, but there's still something to be gained from that sense of closing the loop that he created with that mid-credit scene in Split. So if you only saw Unbreakable in 2000 and you only saw Split in 2016, and you didn't stay through the credits, and you had no inkling whatsoever that these two could ever potentially be connected, then you're fine to skip Glass. If you're intrigued by, oh, that was quite a little Easter egg that they put into Split, and you really want to know how this all in M. Night Shyamalan's sort of mind, how they all connect, then you might be interested in seeing it. I think you can wait for the rental. It took me 18 years to see Unbreakable, but I'm really glad I did. If I had to choose my favorite and go in order, it is in order from the way those movies were produced. Unbreakable, Split, and then this one is at the bottom.
I don't think I can rank Unbreakable and Split because I haven't seen that since college. I saw it in the theater when it came out. But just as you need to see and be familiar with the backstory to enjoy and understand Glass, our next film, I also believe you need to be familiar with not only who Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy are, but also at least limited familiarity with their body of work, mm-hmm. what they did, what they're known for, what kind of slapstick, what kind of comedy, what kind of laughs they were going for. And because we're going to talk about Stan and Ollie, a biopic, a more dramatic biopic of two 1920s, 1930s Hollywood titans. So I hear, because
you weren't around.
Not only was I not around, I've never seen a Laurel and Hardy film, a skit, a bit, a nothing. I knew one was smaller and one was larger.
Right.
I knew they hit their peak in the 30s. That's it. I knew nothing about Laurel and Hardy. I believe, and it might have impacted my enjoyment of this film. Now, you can go in blind. I went in blind, and I understood that they were reenacting their famous sketches, their bits, and there must have been personal and professional baggage that they went through, because this is not a standard biopic. Mm-hmm. This doesn't go from how they met and their rise and their peak. It skips all of that except for an opening scene. And it actually shows us Laurel and Hardy on their decline, not even just gradual decline, but their thud, their bottom. And then in the 1950s, when this takes place, 1953, they're done. They're has-beens. Abbott and Costello have movie posters on the side of the buildings, not Laurel and Hardy. They are old. They're in their 50s, I believe. And they're touring the United Kingdom up and down. They are not playing the Royal Theater. They're playing these second-rate stages, and they're almost half empty, almost, maybe a quarter full, because, you know, even in 53, they're like, oh, my parents thought you were funny. Oh, you're still doing the same material. How cute. Which is why I did not latch, grab onto Stan and Ollie. Do you agree? I know we're deserved. Do you agree?
We're not at that segment
do
yet.
Do you have to understand, know anything about Stan and Ollie before this movie to get it?
It helps tremendously. It really does. I had that same visual cue, you know, that one was skinny and the other was large.
Have you ever seen it?
I think, yes. I seem to remember, I have like very, very vague recollections of seeing some kind, like maybe 16 millimeter films that you rented from the library, that when you'd see like Laurel and Hardy, but also, you know, the Marx Brothers movies and Three Stooges and Abbott and Costello. And so I think that's when I might have had some sort of vague introduction to Laurel and Hardy. So I had a visual cue about them and about their slapstick, but not enough to really have known where this movie might be going. But That being said, when you see the real pictures of Laurel and Hardy at the end of this film, which they sort of showcase a few of the skits and photos of the real guys, you realize that what makes this movie so much more potentially intriguing to anybody who's familiar with the pair is the casting. And so I think they were spot on with the casting. I think the performances are great. You've got Steve Coogan as the skinny Laurel, and you've got John C. Reilly, who just recently had that flop in the Sherlock Holmes and Watson. He's in this one a much stronger role playing Stan. And so I just think that...
Playing Oliver.
Sorry. See, I'm already getting them mixed up. The casting really is critical to any enjoyment of this movie, and it's a pretty slow drama. Nothing much happens. It's kind of static in where it goes. It's not a funny movie. It's got some funny moments, but in the end, it's kind of sad and a little more melancholy than I think most people would expect going into a Laurel and Hardy biopic.
I have no idea if the casting is perfect or if they're miscast. I don't know. I've seen random tweets here and there that Steve Coogan was miscast. He seemed very good to me.
Yeah.
And there's also a divide on which side of the Atlantic you're on. John C. Reilly was nominated for a Critics' Choice Award by the Broadcast Film Critics Association. Steve Coogan was nominated for a BAFTA.
Interesting.
So they split.
Yeah.
I enjoyed both of their performances. John C. Reilly probably does a little bit more heavy lifting than Steve Coogan, but they're both very good. And they're not the only duo on the screen. There's also their wives who come over about halfway through the film to join them on their final legs of their England tour. John C. Reilly's Oliver Hardy, his wife, is Shirley Henderson, and she's wonderful. I've always loved Shirley Henderson, but the scene stealer, the ham chewer, is Stan Laurel's wife. Do you have her actress name written down? It's Nina something.
Yeah, I can't remember.
She plays this thickly accented Russian who's has diva characteristics. She looks for the opportunity in conversation to drop that she once worked on a Preston Sturges picture, even if that opportunity is not even in there. She's like, oh, back when I worked with Preston Sturges. And they amplify how Laurel and Hardy feel about each other. Laurel was the writer. He was the harder worker. He thought he was carrying Hardy along with him. Without Laurel, there would have been no Hardy. On the other hand, Hardy, and especially his wife, thought Laurel worked him too hard, pushed him too hard, took him for granted. And they have it at the end. My favorite scene is when they have it out in the dining room. They're like, you know, they didn't put us together because we were great friends. They put us together because we look and work like a duo, a Laurel and Hardy. That's why we're together. It's not because we're good friends and we like to hang out with one another.
Well, but that was where it was sort of heartbreaking, because they had different perspectives on that, where you had Oliver Hardy basically saying to Stan, you know, you love Laurel and Hardy. You never loved me.
That's right. That's exactly the quote. That's a great quote. Hal Roach put him together. Hal Roach actually shows up in the beginning, played by Danny Houston, in a wonderful, long tracking shot from Dressing Room 2. I think must be their most famous dance routine in this Western movie I should know about, but I have no idea. And I know it has larger context. And that's when you get all the information about why they fight with one another. And your great quote. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah.
You love Laurel and Hardy. You don't love me.
Right. And Nina Arianda was
very
the
good
woman who played
what a
Ida.
Hand stealer.
she was really good. I loved when she was supposed to be. She always made a point of not having to sit next to sort of the sleazy manager producer guy when they'd be out in the theater. She was a strong woman. They were both strong women in their own rights and really supported Laurel and Hardy in their efforts, even though you didn't really think they were going to when you first meet them. But in the end, you kind of feel that bond that does exist between all four of them. And in order to really get that feeling of the casting being what I think is pretty spot on is then I went and I watched on YouTube their only live, the pair's only live television performance ever together was a This Is Your Life, where it was sprung on them, the surprise. And it was actually that same producer guy, Bernard, that we see in the film that doesn't come off as the greatest kind of guy. But apparently their relationship really, their professional relationship sustained and their friendship over the years. And he was in on trying to surprise them with this appearance on This Is Your Life. And when you watch them all and the wives show up too there, you really do see how the movie really does portray them, I think, as accurately as it could, considering nobody probably really knows 100% what went on with their relationship and in their individual families and in their minds as to who was pulling their weight with what. And they also were kind of victims of the Hollywood studio system. And that's really what had caused them to really break up for like 16 years or something before they came back and did the stage act with the hope of relaunching their movie careers. And it didn't really happen. But the stage tour did actually end up in the end taking off and doing really well. So once, even though it started off really slow, once Laurel and Hardy agreed to do all these sort of personal appearances and be seen more out on the streets doing their shtick, it drew audiences back into the stage. And so it was sort of a comeback for them, but wasn't ever going to be enough to really bring them back into the that glamorous world of Hollywood when new acts were just coming into the fray.
I did not walk away from Stan and Ollie with the feeling, with the impression that this was an actual celebration of the two. You get that sometimes, that like Bohemian Rhapsody was a celebration of Freddie Mercury. This is not celebrating these two. This is actually more just a nostalgic picture. There was a time, there was a place when first a duo named named Laurel and Hardy ruled Hollywood. People loved their comedy. And then there was a time in the 50s when they were your parents' comedians. It's like one day how my kid will feel about Jerry Seinfeld. And I'm like, what do you mean you don't find him hysterical? Because his comedy will sound dated. Mm-hmm. And that, so it's about a time and a place and an era and some men. It's not a celebration.
Yeah, it took me a while to get into it too. And they were pretty smart to keep the running time pretty tight. It's about an hour and a half long. And that's about as long as it really could have been. And it's kind of sad. You see how fleeting fame can really be in the scheme of things. These people that are, you know, just celebrated so much, and then suddenly their stars just begin to fade. But you do get a sense watching this film. The part I did like was that they really did enjoy making people laugh and smile, whether it was on stage or just in real life, that was so important to them. And it really was a part of who they were. So yeah, this movie, Stan and Ollie, I mean, do I think you have to rush out to a theater and see it? No. If you're a fan of the duo and a fan of Steve Coogan and John C. Reilly, then yeah, it's a reminder of this duo and what they achieved and a bit of a time gone by. So it's melancholy and a bit somber more than a comedy, but good performances and just a quiet tribute, I guess.
Speaking of melancholy and somber, let's talk about our third film, a foreign film that will be nominated for a Best Foreign Film Oscar. I'm just going ahead. The nominations are not out yet as of this recording, but I'm going to go ahead and say it will be nominated.
And we'll lose to Roma.
And it's from Poland, and it's from a director we know, Paweł Pawlikowski, because we know him because he already won a Best Foreign Film Oscar in 2013 for Ida. I loved Ida. Joanna Kulig, we see her again in this film, played a nun in that post-Soviet Poland, which is just a gut-wrenching, amazing film, and I still remember and cherish. And it was in black and white, as is Cold War. Mm-hmm. It's also in crisp, velvety, gorgeous black and white. I'm supposed to love this movie. I have to read it. It's in black and white. It's by Pawlikowski. I didn't love this film at all. I was somewhat abhorred by it, by Cold War. It's allegedly a romance. You called them star-crossed lovers, and with external factors pulling them apart, and I couldn't disagree more. They were already out of Poland One had defected. One had joined him later. And then one goes back. I'm so confused. I want to start with this before we even talk about the plot or whatever. I'm so confused why the film community loves this movie. Why what they see in these characters that I cannot see.
Well, it's somewhat ironic, Charlie, because I sort of liked it.
Oh, my God.
I saw it at Middleburg. This is one of those ones that, because I saw it months ago in October at the Middleburg Film Festival. And I remember just thinking that what made it unique was that it felt like such a throwback. You felt like, unlike Roma, which is in black and white, is this beautiful cinematography. With this one, though, you truly felt like you were watching a film made in the 1950s and a romance that was made in the 1950s. And I think the reason that it's got some buzz going is that just like Alfonso Cuarón's Roma was based on his own family experiences in Mexico, this was actually inspired, the story of this couple was inspired by real-life events in the family of Pavel Pawlikowski. And so I think those things resonate with the system, within the system. People like when a director puts some of their own personal history and feeling into a film that they're doing, that it makes it sort of a labor of love for them. I hated the ending of Cold War, I will give you that. It was described at the opening, somebody did some spiel going into the screening of this film, and I recall them saying that this was an epic love story, and epic only because it spans, I think, a few decades of...
But it only spans 89 minutes.
And yes, it only spans 89 minutes. But it's like watching an old classic movie. And so I think for those of us that just sort of like those old romances, the chemistry between the two lead actors, between Joanna Kulig as Zula and Tomas Kot as Victor, that's what sells this film, is that there is a palpable chemistry, I thought. And so so did many who were around me in the theater screening this. We all just kind of felt the performances and the music. There's great music in this movie.
Good Lord, the music. I love the jazz. I've been listening to it on Spotify all week. Joanna Kulig as this smoky, sultry jazz singer that she transforms into during the film. She grows from this little country bumpkin rural folk singer into this, you know, this nightclub jazz singer, and those songs are really good.
Yeah, and I mean, this movie uses music to play a significant role about the politics. It integrates Polish folk music. There's Parisian jazz when they're suddenly in Paris. There's some early rock and roll that's kind of fun to see that springs up throughout this film. I mean, the romance part, you know, it's like their romance is undermined by all that's going on with the politics and their own character flaws. And then there's all these unfortunate twists of fate that just follow this pair across Poland and Berlin and Yugoslavia and Paris and back to Poland. But yeah, no, I think it might be just a little too chick flicky up until the end.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. You're talking about chemistry. Okay, I think they do have some chemistry, but you talk about romance. They actually spend as much time deliberately hurting one another as loving one another.
Oh, I do not disagree. It is a totally dysfunctional, can't live with them, can't live without him story.
It begins in the immediate aftermath of World War II in newly Soviet Poland, and they're trying to create this new idea, this new history that probably never existed. Victor is going around the Polish countryside collecting these old, probably centuries old, folk tunes, and they're going to create this new music school and get all these kids to learn these songs, and they're going to sing Polish, and they're going to be the epitome of Poles, and they're going to travel the Eastern Bloc showing Poland that we've always had this great history, which they haven't. And Victor establishes probably an unsanctioned relationship with one of his students, Zula. It's a student-teacher relationship, and I think there is an age difference there, but I never learned what it is.
Yeah,
I actually don't know how far apart they are. But he's an authority figure over her, and they begin a sexual relationship. Fair enough, whatever. It's the
50s. But she's manipulative. You've got to give her that. No. She's totally seducing him and manipulating
him. They each have pasts.
Yeah.
Hers is mentioned. Hers is, it's mostly hers. She's got a very interesting, intriguing past. That's only mentioned. You don't really dive into it. You don't know his past at all. And Zula boomerangs between he is good enough, he is not good enough. He is good, he is not good for me. Until her choice finally puts to bed any kind of stable, healthy life they could ever leave. She makes a choice, and it destroys both of them. It destroys both of them for at least 20 years.
That's right.
You know, and critics just hold the story as aloft as like one of the year's great love stories. But all I can see are these soap operatic melodrama with geopolitics just hanging out in the background.
Yeah, you're right. No, that's all there. I completely agree that's all in there. I watch soaps, so maybe that's that melodramatic soap-ish kind of vibe makes this a foreign film that I can appreciate a little more. I never did see Ida, mostly because that was back
Clash.
It was BCC, before Cinema Clash era.
That was before I made you watch all these.
Before you made me watch these kind of films, when I happily deferred them to Artie Chick to review for Chick Flicks. And so Artie Chick did indeed review it back in 2014, I think. And she loved it, absolutely loved it. And I think we both Artie Chick and I really, for slightly different reasons, did enjoy Cold War. I don't think either of us was totally blown away by it. I think I still might, you know, I don't know if there's that many foreign films out there. It's on my top 10.
Foreign film is loaded this year.
It is loaded. So, I mean, I'm not sure that it would necessarily, it wouldn't be in my top spot, but it would be in like my top 10 of foreign films this year. The fact that I watch more than 10 foreign films this year, and it hit that sweet spot, which I might have to go back and watch Ida someday because I saw that one was 80 minutes.
He just fascinated.
So Pavlovsky absolutely knows.
Pavlikovsky.
Oh my goodness. So his sweet spot, obviously, for running time is in that 80-minute range, and so I'm glad that
that's your kind of movie.
That's my sweet spot for foreign films as well.
It will be nominated for Best Foreign Film, and it could accidentally sneak into that fifth spot in cinematography.
I think it could slip into the fifth spot.
And I've heard Joanna Kulig mentioned, but I'd be shocked. I can't believe I'm in the minority on a black and white foreign film from Poland. I'm supposed to love
you
this film.
Are.
I'm supposed to be up in the chimney tops
and
right
I'm,
now
I'm
shouting
supposed
about
to
this
hate
film.
It because I had to read it.
I
and
borderline
it's in black
hated
and white.
This film because
I
could not identify, latch on to, support, empathize with these two people.
I hated what they were doing to each other. So there were parts of this film that made me mad, and I hated her manipulation of him and how much of a sucker he kept being. So
what
while you you borderline hated it, I actually borderline liked it. And not loved it, but liked it. And I do have a sneaking suspicion that it will get that fifth spot as Poland submission for Best Foreign Language.
No. It's going to be in the top two of foreign. I'm talking about it's going to sneak into that fifth spot in cinematography.
Don't know. Maybe. I'm not sure about that one.
All right. That's our film reviews this week. Let's jump over to our new smashing success segment called Agree or Disagree. We trotted this out last week. I offer Hannah an opinion. She has no idea what it is, and she just has to immediately gut reaction. I agree because, I disagree because. And we open it up to the audience, say, why don't you know what we like? Shoot us some opinions. Let us launch at each other. And you did. So, Hannah, do you want to go first? You want me to launch at you?
Well, I'm not even going with one that somebody actually launched at us intentionally, but we are taking a tweet from our good friend Christian Hamaker, who tweeted this week that, actually today, that he felt that the bottom six of the Hollywood Reporter's list of Oscar frontrunners is comprised of much more interesting films than the top five. So the top five were Alfonso Cuarón for Roma, Bradley Cooper for A Star Is Born, Spike Lee for Black Klansman, Peter Farrelly for Green Book, and Adam McKay for Vice.
Now, so you're talking about Best
so
Director here.
He posted this list that was Director, Best Director, but I think he was also referring to the films as a whole. And so the bottom portion of that list was your buddy Yorgos Lanthimos for The Favorite, Lynn Ramsey for You Were Never Really Here, Paul Schrader for First Reformed, Deborah Granik for Leave No Trace, and Pavlikovsky for Cold War, and Damien Chazelle for First Man. So Christian's claim is that those bottom six are more interesting than the top five. I personally disagree. Charlie, agree or disagree?
I agree. The only one I really, in the top five, the only one I agree with that list is Roma, Alfonso Cuarón. The bottom five, Yorgos Lanthimos, Leave No Trace, First Man, I'm all about it. Stars Born, no. Vice, no. Green Book, no. I can throw those off my list easily. I'm not latched on to this bottom six. I don't think it's my favorite, but Christian, brother, you're right. The bottom six is far more intriguing than the top five. I agree.
And I disagree because I just feel like those top five are more overall enjoyable, entertaining, and attainable for the masses to appreciate and to enjoy and to see. And the lower ones are more niche films. And so they're the kind of films a lot that you might see more in the Spirit Awards kind of category, but not the Oscars.
Yeah.
Your turn. Yeah, agree or disagree, Charlie?
Hannah, I'm going to go a little bit. I'm going to go into the future a little bit. I'm going to go into the near future. Hannah, John Wick, Chapter 3, Parabellum, is going to be 10 kinds of awesome.
It's so funny. My second agree or disagree. The new trailer for John Wick Chapter 3 dropped this week. Looks killer. That's actually my second one.
I don't watch trailers. I saw the movie poster, though.
And I saw the trailer. And so I have to say, 100% agree. It is not my typical genre, but I have enjoyed the previous two John Wick movies. And this trailer looks pretty freaking awesome. And so I agree, and I'm looking forward to John Wick Chapter 3.
Okay, and I guess that was mine.
But. Well, that was yours, but it was also mine, and you're in right. The exact same spot. That's
awesome.
Really
That's
freaky.
Good. Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and say John Wick, when the first one came out a couple years ago, we all go back and we realize we write so many reviews that every now and then we get it wrong. And John Wick, I got it wrong. I bit off on the puppy. And how I didn't latch on, like that was his motivation, was the puppy. But I've since come around. I was wrong when John Wick, I throttled it. I gave it a thumbs down, a marginal review. But yeah, I was completely wrong.
And I came to it late. I think that's one where I actually caught up watching the first John Wick when the second one came out. And was really just, wow, this is really a good movie and a good franchise. And so now I'm kind of psyched for Chapter 3.
All right, that was your second.
So. Yeah, so that was both of our seconds.
I still got two more.
So. Go for it.
Kumail Nanjiani and Tracy Ellis Ross will unveil the Oscar nominations on Tuesday morning at 8:20 a.m. Eastern Standard. I'm still not going to watch it live.
5:30?
That's Western time. 8:30 Eastern. I've been at work for 2 hours. I'm still not going to watch it live, even though I could live stream it on anything out there. No, I'm just going to wait for some news article to print it up. I'm not watching that stuff live. Are you crazy?
I can't agree or disagree because in the past, if my schedule allows and I'm in front of a television or a computer, I will, out of curiosity, tune it in because I like the instant gratification of knowing whether there are surprises and snubs and whether or not the things that I really want to get through do. So I do like watching the nominations. I don't set an alarm. Of course, I should be up by then and getting ready for work. But if time allows and the opportunity is there to see it, I will watch it live because I do think that there's a shock value and an entertainment value to watching it live.
Meh.
Yeah, so I've got one with them. We've gotten a gazillion emails over the past few weeks about an Indian movie called Cat Sticks. Have you gotten those for Slam Dance? It's premiering at Slam Dance. I've gotten so many emails about this that I'm actually less inclined to see the film. So when that happens, are you more inclined or less inclined to see a movie?
I deleted every single one of them. And it could be the best movie ever made. But we already watch 3 to 4 to 5 movies every week. And they're the ones that are actually being released in theaters that people out there in whatever state you're in could go and see, even the ones that we think are even DC local. I don't have time to watch stuff that are premiering at a film festival. I'm not even going to.
Well, I have nothing against the Slamdance Film Festival, and I think it's a big deal, I'm sure, for this film that that this is their world premiere. But it's just a note to publicists out there that one or two really good emails about a film that really draw you into wanting to see it, because I have been known to, you know, to respond and say, sure, send me the link, and watching something that I might not otherwise watch. But when I get like five in the course of 48 hours, five emails with the exact same, touting the exact same thing, I actually lose interest with each progressive one.
Most of those emails we get like that are for movies that are preparing on video on demand on whatever, you know, whatever system. And I think I did a couple last year just because you're right. It's the ones that piqued my interest. I did the one about Cecil B. DeMille's Lost City that he built for that movie. It was a documentary that no one else saw, but I just wanted to watch it so bad. So I did. But yeah, the ones that I get nine emails on, yeah. Like, oh my God.
We may never have seen Basmati Rice if we had not gotten one of those emails.
No, you got to bring that up. All right.
Wait, I have one more.
Well, it's your turn.
I'm sorry. Go for it.
Best Supporting Actor. Mm-hmm. When Kumail Nanjiani and Tracee Ellis Ross, whatever, say, we're going to hear Mahershala Ali. We're going to hear Richard E. Grant. We're going to hear one or both of the Sams, Sam Elliott, Sam Rockwell, and some either Timothy Chalamet or Adam Driver. That's it, right? There's six names there. There's five slots. But, however, I am, fingers crossed, rooting for, accidentally, someone slips up and says, Hugh Grant, Paddington 2.
You know what? I do recall now that Hugh Grant was very good in Paddington 2.
It was amazing.
I love Paddington 2. It was such a sweet film. It had such a great little message. And I don't know, it kind of got lost, I think, because it came out so early. But yeah, he actually really did a very good job in that movie. So he's always good in these supporting roles. He did get nominated for, he was in, I think, that one, Florence Foster Jenkins.
Well, Meryl got nominated. Did he get nominated?
But I think he might have gotten some nominations as supporting actor, or he should have, because he was really good in that one.
I want to see, you know, maybe he replaces Adam Driver, Sam Rockwell, and they just say, Mahershala, Richard E. Grant, Timothy Chalamet, Sam Elliott, and Hugh Grant.
I agree that it would be very funny and deserved in its own sort of way. So it's definitely a reminder that sometimes those best supporting character roles are just those scene-stealing moments that just remind you how good an actor somebody is and how much range they really do have. Because I think Hugh Grant is one of those sort of underappreciated actors. I mean, I can watch About a Boy 100 times over and just really love him in that one. So, yeah, so go Hugh. I think we should start a hashtag campaign.
Go Hugh. It's too late. Everyone's already nominated.
Oh, well. Are we done?
I thought you said you had one more.
Well, my last one's sort of a closing one, agree or disagree. We are based in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area.
We are.
Thank goodness we host a podcast about movies rather than politics. Agree or disagree, Charlie?
Agree. I can't talk about politics. I can't read about it. I'm tired of thinking about it. I couldn't do a podcast on politics. I would lose my mind.
I agree.
I can't even go downtown this weekend because the metro is packed and so is the mall with competing pro and anti-abortion rallies. That's living in D.C. is awesome, but sometimes living in D.C. sucks.
Yeah. Well, and then this weekend is supposed to be actually the latest Women's March, which apparently has had all sorts of controversies surrounding it. But yeah, we could go on. There's so many things that we could go on just by nature of where we live. But I'm really happy to be talking about our absolute opposing views on films like Cold War.
Which should have been the opposite. Yeah, D.C. is a great film town. It's not New York. It's not L.A. But you know what? It's in the top six of film towns in the United States. And we get D.C. gets a lot of film attention. So I'm glad I live here. But yeah. On most days, on days when there's a rally downtown and I can't get on a train, then I have a problem. But all right, quick recap. Glass. Ah, what a, he swung the bat, but what a big swing and the miss by M. Night Shyamalan.
It's a bit of a miss, but it's still worth catching. if you saw Unbreakable and Split and want to sort of see that the conclusion to that narrative.
I am shocked. I'm shocked that Stan and Ollie is the best film of the week, because it was okay. It's an odd portion of their life to devote a biopic to. I learned a lot about Laurel and Hardy because I came in knowing nothing about Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah, it grew on me. I liked it better after I finished watching it than I did during the watching experience. It's another one that helps to have some frame of reference going in for who Laurel and Hardy were. But it's not going to be for everybody, but it's still a decent one. It's PG, but I can't imagine any kid actually wanting to see this.
No kid's gonna watch this movie.
Yeah, so it's odd that it was a PG rating. I would have made it at least PG-13, but there are no curse words in it. Stan and Ollie, I agree. It's an okay film, and none of these are going to be on anybody's must-see list.
I don't know what it says about the film or what it says about me that I did not take to and love a Polish film I had to read in black and white that takes place in the 50s. I should have connected to this, but I borderline hated Cold War.
I borderline liked it. Chemistry between the leads, music playing a big role, and it's beautifully shot. And so for a foreign film, for me, I liked it. So there you go.
She reminded me how much I loved Ida. thanks again for all of your contributions to Agree or Disagree. Please do it again. This is great. We ask each other questions we would never think about asking each other. It's been some great conversation. So keep pitching us individually or collectively on the Cinema Clash Twitter. Yeah. Agree or disagree questions, and we'll keep agreeing and disagreeing.
Yeah, hashtag agree or disagree. And
if you don't want me to see it, send it to Hannah. If you don't want her to see it, send it to me.
And or you can send it to at the Cinema Clash. You can tweet it to us that way.
All right. Well, thank you for taking the time to listen to us about the movies that are new to theaters this week. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.